Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Lee Lakeman. She has spent her adult life working against violence against women and continues to do so past retirement. She worked on the earliest rape crisis center since 1973 and raised a son on her own to adulthood. So first, I would like to thank you for your work, and second, I would like to thank you for being on the program.
You're very welcome.
So the first question is, you know, as we said, you opened one of the first women's shelters in Canada and have spent decades fighting male violence against women.
That's right.
So you write, these politics are as deeply personal as any other love. So, you know, your love is very obvious in your life's work. But A, can you talk about the relationship between love and activism? And B, can you talk about your deeply personal reasons for choosing the politics that you have?
Sure. Well, when I was first active, I was studying journalism, actually, in Toronto, and got pregnant through a foreign student, with a foreign student, African man. And so suddenly I was in the situation of confronting the adult problems of women in Canada. And I knew I couldn't continue studies. There was no child care at that point. There was no supports for somebody in my position. And I didn't even know that welfare existed. I'd grown up in a sort of modestly middle-class family, but wouldn't know how to get welfare. But I did figure out how to survive. I withdrew from school, but I began to suddenly have to confront all the things that women are up against, and particularly women who've broken any of the rules, for instance, by getting pregnant without a man to whom I was married or with whom I was partners. And so that sort of sharpened me up. And then within a couple of years, I had run into this situation. I was living in a co-op house, and my woman friend told me about a woman who had no place to go, and when I said, you know, we had a spare room, we could take her, my friend told me, well, she's not the only one. This is a regular occurrence that women are getting hit and have nowhere to go. So pretty quickly, my friends moved out of the co-op house, and I began to fill up the co-op house with women who were escaping abusive men, and that's kind of how I got into it. So there was never really any separation for me between what I was personally involved in and trying to do and what the movement was beginning to invent. We didn't even have words like Transition House at that point, but quickly that's what we were doing. And about love, I think it's important to say that this is not an impersonal politics, that I was sharing a house with women, so I was sharing parenting with women, short term at least, because I was there with my child. And gradually I realized that the closest relationships in my life were the women I was working with, who began to become a team to make that house and since then other houses and other centers work. So there was those bonds, but there were also bonds between me and the women who were calling. And they're probably the strongest bonds of my life.
So I'm thinking about what you said about how there really wasn't an infrastructure in place, and how something I've said often over the decades, is that you know, my father was extremely violent. He broke my sister's arm. My brother has epilepsy from blows to the head. He raped my sister, my mother, and me. And one of the reasons that my mother didn't leave is because there weren't battered women's shelters in the 1950s and 60s.
And that's right. There weren't.
What?
I'm amazed you're here to talk about it and glad you're talking about it. Excuse me.
I mean, it's extraordinary to me. I guess not extraordinary. It's part of patriarchy. But, I mean, what options were there, really, for women?
In one sense, there were none. What's true is that informally, women took each other in and always have, but it became increasingly difficult to do so in the post-war years. People were living in smaller and smaller units, not the big old farmhouse anymore, or even the big old city house. there wasn't room to take in your sister or your friend and her children. So that, you know, that began to create the need for us to find another way to collectivize our responses. But I think it's also true that the whole economic conditions after the Second World War were changing. Whole families were migrating. The people were moving from the country to the city. A lot of things were changing, and it created the necessity for us to figure out some way to support each other. And at the same time, women were kind of catching on to the structure of patriarchy. So as we tried out these strategies, you know, let's keep a back room in the women's center and gradually gets over full, or let's use Lee's house and we'll gather women there. We never imagined how many there were. We never imagined it for a minute. And until we had central centers in which women could hide and gather, we didn't know how many there were. There was no count of who goes to police. There's no count of how much violence against women there actually is, except in the shelters and in the rape crisis centers.
There's two directions I want to go with this. One of them is sure. that I've known peripherally, I haven't known them very well, but peripherally in my life, I've known several women who back in the 50s and 60s and early 70s were part of explicit underground railroads.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk about that at all while I try to remember what the second thing was? Oh, the second thing. The second thing is this line that I read about incest, but is I think true to this too, which is when you're talking about how people were surprised at how many, or some people were surprised at how many women needed this help. There's this great line about incest where it says incest is not really a taboo. What is a taboo is talking about the incest that is happening a lot.
That's exactly right.
And so
that's exactly right.
So can you go those sure. two questions in whatever order you want?
Sure. So in 73, you know, really 72, 73, 74, centers were opening across North America, also in England. And that's when we begin to actually see how much violence there is, ranging from how much rape there is and sexual harassment to how much wife battering and incest there is going on. And they're all interlocked, of course. So as we begin to open shelters, you notice that there's a number of women who are small, frail, blonde, who come just as their girl children are hitting intimacy because the men that they're partnered with are beginning to move their predatory behavior from the women they married to their daughters. And it's the same, you know, it's they just move, they keep the fantasy woman in their head and they move it to the younger and younger women. So we see the incest because we're responding to the wife assault. And the same is true on sexual harassment. The thing is that if it's the boss who was harassing you, raping you, or threatening you with rape, you might not need the housing of the transition house, but you do need the solidarity and the connection to other women. And part of what women figured out is that we could think better if we were in groups. That's really part of what happened, that as soon as we got into either women's centers or transition houses or rape crisis centers, all of a sudden we found ourselves able to find language to describe what was happening to us, and being able to notice our own passive language, or notice that if we were together, we could say it more clearly, or we could identify more clearly what was happening. And once you can do that, you're much freer to act. So those centers became places to hide, but also places to gather steam and from which you could act as a group or as an individual.
So this makes me think of a study I heard, and and let me know if this is off base or not, that mm-hmm. It was called the second voice idea. And what they did for an experiment is they had a bunch of people thought they were waiting in a waiting room, but the truth is they're part of the psychological experiment. And then you have one person walk in and say something really racist or really sexist, and then you see how the people in the room respond. And what they found, and then you had one other person who was a plant, and the other person who was a plant, if the person validated that racism or sexism, they found everybody else in the room was like, oh, well, then it must be okay. But if the second person challenged them on it, challenged the original offensive statement, then everybody else in the room, that the second voice was in some ways even more important than the first voice. And I'm just thinking about, in terms of especially something like abuse, where the victim is being gaslighted, how incredibly important it can be to just have somebody else say, hey, that's really crazy what happened to you. That shouldn't happen.
That's very close to how we describe the role of a feminist within the service. So it matters very much how I respond when a woman calls the Rape Crisis Center. I have a partner in that work. There'll be a senior woman as well as a more junior woman responding to the caller. But it's absolutely the role of the feminist to be conscious in how she responds to what she's being told. So, for instance, a professional psychologist or mental health worker might respond by muting their own emotional and political intellectual response to the violence because they think that's important in the job they're doing. But a feminist needs to respond by saying, I'm appalled. I'm appalled at what's happening, and I'm worried for you. Are you safe? Can I get you safe? Could you come and be safe while you think about what to do? It's a much more emotionally and intellectually connected response to what is appalling, dangerous behavior. And when you get that response from someone, it's easier to ground your own fears and your own worries about what to do. You know, you're getting reinforced for it. But the analogy that you put forward is also a bit wrong in that there's no outsider in the situation that we're experiencing. So it's much more the Paulo Freire conception in that if you put people together who are sharing the same experience, as long as one of you makes the effort to articulate what's going on, it's more possible for the others to articulate. And so what you're looking for is to find common language so that you can begin to act in common. So we're not in a waiting room. It's the fundamental of our lives. We're actually living isolated from each other. And when we can break that isolation by being together and one of us telling the truth first, it's much more possible for the others to tell the truth.
You know, this also reminds me of R.D. Lang's Three Rules of a Dysfunctional Family. And R.D. Lang was such an abusive jerk, and he articulated so much of the abuse process really well.
Yeah.
But anyway, leaving that aside, you have the Three Rules of a Dysfunctional Family are: Rule A is don't, Rule A1 is Rule A does not exist, and Rule A2 is never discuss the existence or non-existence of Rules A1 or A2.
Exactly. Yeah, that's right. So, you know, part of what we're saying is the family structure is burying the woman. And when we can make the social experience that she's having more about community and less about family, then we begin to get toward a movement. You know, so once she's gathered up with other women, although her children are there and, you know, nothing fundamentally has changed, but she does now have the beginning of a group experience in which she's not being abused. It's amazing watching children around a dinner table, for instance, in a transition house. They nearly, if they've had a father, like it sounds like you experienced, kids come to the table ready for trouble. They know there's going to be trouble. It's always trouble. And so they're hyped up, and they're either, they got all their defenses ready, which is either silence or to have a fit or something. And in fact, they're disconcerted by the fact that there is no bad guy in the house. Hmm. And so it takes a little cleverness on the part of the women at the table to get kids through a couple of meals where it's peaceful and pleasant and the kids have a good time. And then, you know, then they're really invested in staying in the house and being there. But at first they don't know what to do with it because there's always, it's a site of trouble for them.
Yeah. Two things. One is that a specific memory I have when I was a kid was my father leaping over the table to chase and beat my brother. And
right.
What I did, I specifically remember, is I continued to eat because that's what you do at the table. And
horrible.
You said that rape crisis centers and transition houses have been significant collective social change agents.
Yes.
And you've I think been making clear what that means through the conversation so far, but can you be really explicit about,
yeah,
even more explicit than you have been about that?
Yeah. I'm trying to write about it now, actually, and it's hard because not very many other people have. But I think most people think of transition houses and rape crisis centers as kind of low-rent social work, or as very least as a service delivery model. And I don't think about them that way. And what I'm talking about when I say social change is that it's on multiple levels. First of all, I think that for the women who call us, they know very well when they're calling a feminist center. I mean, in some places, that's not what they get anymore when they call for a transition house or a rape crisis center. But there's still a fundamental notion that women have, that they're calling other women, and they're calling because of a gigantic social problem in which they're caught up. So they are thinking about the individual man who attacked them, but they're also thinking there's a whole thing going on here and I'm part of this whole thing. And they call feminists on purpose, knowing that we're not government and knowing that we're not the law exactly, although we use the law sometimes, and knowing that we have made some kind of promise that they understand about confidentiality, about being part of a team, about responding to each other. So they expect me to understand in a way that a social worker doesn't, and in a way that a policeman doesn't. And that's my job, to understand in that way. And the first thing that a good rape crisis center does is make that a group. So instead of her calling a counselor or even an uncredentialed counselor, what she gets is a worker, somebody who identifies herself as an anti-violence worker. And usually that woman also has a partner. So the first thing that happens is it's not a one-to-one relationship, it's you're entering a small group relationship. And then if you're really good at it, and you stick to the original principles, you begin to do consciousness raising work right away in that small group. And by that I mean that the two workers are not hiding their lives. They're also responding to her saying, yeah, I get it, and or saying, some of this has happened to me, that's why I get it, or I'm afraid of the same things as you, that's part of why I get it. And I'm not telling you that I know more than you because I took a bunch of courses. I'm telling you that I'm willing to be an ally to you in trying to solve this problem. And I'm one of the people who's not in crisis right now. And that's a completely different relationship than a professional relationship. And so from there on, we're kind of on a journey together of In the best possible circumstances, that woman goes from being isolated, victimized, to being much more connected and much more willing to be of assistance to other women. And that's the journey that we want to have happen. So the best centers are full of women who called as callers and who go on to be significant players in the resistance to male violence against women around the world. It doesn't mean that every woman has been completely brutalized or that every caller becomes a full-time activist, but in some way, that's the relationship that's going on. And then that affects everything from how we do advocacy to what kind of social change we're fighting for to what our alliances are like organization to organization. And we are creating a whole wing of the independent women's movement that way.
A couple of things. One of them is that it sounds like the language that I've heard from both Robert J. Lifton and Judith Herman about this is that you are part of the hope is that not only can you help women to become safe, you can help them to find a survivor mission, to use their language.
Yep.
And the second thing is what is the social change that you are attempting to bring about on the larger scale? Can you talk about that explicitly?
Sure. This, too, I don't think is written about enough. There's no question that those who invented rape crisis centers and transition houses were feminists. They, in those days, they would have said women's liberation. I would have said women's liberation, by which I meant that it was a self-organized movement of women who saw themselves as trying to change all the structures of the world, trying to get rid of the class oppression of women as well as the race oppression of women, and knowing that that would affect everybody's race oppression. It affects men as well, but our fundamental place to stand was among women, and the force that we were gathering was the force of women to resist those powers. And that we just had picked a particular place to stand in that overall transformation. So I, for instance, think it's ridiculous to talk about a right-wing feminist. I don't think there's any such thing. And there's no possibility of being willingly racist feminist. I mean, obviously, feminists make class and race mistakes, and we make sex mistakes, too. But to be a practicing feminist means that you're working for all the women of the world, and the majority of the women of the world are poor and brown. So you can't be a serious feminist unless you're taking on the issues of race and class divisions in the world and of what is holding women down. And I'm clearly saying that violence against women, more and more it's clear, that violence against women is a repressive force. It prevents women's self-activism, not just on the individual level, but on the whole societal level. And you can see it now around the world that women, as women are self-organizing internationally, they almost always express themselves as taking on violence against women as well as taking on poverty.
I'm sorry if this is a stupid question, but how could someone think that violence against women was not a force, was not an attempt?
Yeah.
I don't understand why that is. It's great you're articulating it, but I don't understand why that even has to be articulated. It seems so obvious.
Because the majority of those who are talking about violence against women are not revolutionaries. And what they do is talk about it as a series of incidents or a series of a limited number of bad guys. And in either case, you get the wrong picture overall. So what we're saying is violence against women is a force that is made up of the individual behavior of individual men, but it's made up of more than that, too. And that overall force affects all women, not just the women who are actually beaten, because it's there as a threat against all women. And that threat benefits all men, whether or not men want it to, it does. And so if you're a serious fighter against capitalism or class oppression, you would understand that it's not the behavior just of individual capitalists that you're attacking. You're attacking the whole thing. And it's the same with violence against women. Violence against women is like a right-wing death squad. It functions for the dictator. It functions for the system, even if no one's actively directing it. And believe me, they often are actively directing it.
Well,
is that clearer?
Yeah. It's the thing. I completely agree with you. And the thing that I'm having, that I guess I've always had a hard time with, is understanding how people could not understand that. Because we understand that when there was a public lynching in 1872,
right,
that the target was not merely the individual who was killed for not accepting the low price on his cotton, but instead was his neighbors.
Exactly.
And I don't understand why we have such a hard time understanding that when it comes to lynching. But I mean, an easy time understanding on lynching, but a hard time understanding it when we watch Dr. Zhivago and you see Evgrav, the character, starts to rape Lara, and by the end of the scene, she's pushing him away, and by the end of the scene, she's pulling him close. I don't understand how we can't see that as propaganda.
Or
on the
large
scale.
But, you know, there's pretty big machinery working on making sure that most people don't get it. I think in some ways the normalcy of the oppression of women hides it. In some ways, the normalcy of violence against women is hidden from us, but also hides the systemic nature of the oppression. And people do have a hard time seeing it. And in my, you know, in when I was living through the 70s, there was so much great talk about it that it was more possible to see. It's harder again now to see. We're so much more encouraged to see ourselves as individual and not part of groups, and it's so much harder to hold a coherent view of the world and see the systems of power that are in place. It's just a lot harder now.
Yeah, I've talked to Gail Dines about, she and I have thrown out the idea of doing a book on how neoliberalism has destroyed radical movements.
Yes.
Because it's also true in the environmental movement. This is true across the board.
Sure.
Let's back up a little ways. You know, we're talking about men's violence against women, and we sort of skipped a little bit the Underground Railroad thing. And you know, we talked around it, but I guess can you bring home? I shouldn't use that phrase, but to talk about the What are the figures on when a woman tries to leave an abusive partner? What is it, 7 times more likely she'll be killed? What's the, I don't remember the number.
It is a lot higher. That's fairly recent news, like the last few years, the last 10 years maybe. We know now that for about 18 months after she succeeds at leaving him, she's in danger. But she's obviously in a great deal more danger than usual between when she first thinks of leaving and when she actually succeeds in getting away and getting through that 18 months. Because, you know, couples are close. And once he perceives that she might leave, that her usual being caught in the cycle has come apart and she's beginning to actually make moves toward actually leaving, then he's really threatened. And then the danger goes up. You know, but we've known for a while that the likelihood of a beating goes up as soon as she begins to be in a better relationship to change. Like if she gets a bit of a university degree and begins to complete the course, then the danger goes up. If she gets pregnant and is more vulnerable to him, then the violence goes up. So we know that, you know, when you disturb the relationship, whatever it is, that temporarily the danger goes up. And then, you know, obviously it goes way down once you get away from it. So, but you've got to get through that danger period. And so we have to be very, very careful once women begin to contact us saying that they want to leave. Then we want to, you know, accompany her as closely as we can until she actually gets out.
What?
Underground Railway. I guess what I want to say about that is that a lot of people romanticized what we were doing. There absolutely was an Underground Railway, and in some way there still is. But there was long before anybody called it that, too. As soon as transition houses existed, even women's centers, which preceded them a bit, women hid each other. And, you know, that is the Underground Railway. And it's just that if you say Underground Railway, it implies that we were passing women from one house to another. And we did that, but nobody really talked about it that way. We just did it. And it was common in the most conservative of houses. It was common to have a pot of money that nobody knew about, or a church you knew you could go to, or a richer person that you knew you could go to for a bus ticket or a plane ticket to move women on who needed to move on quickly out of one constituency into another. And I've always said, and more as things went on, that you can't have law students working in transition houses, for instance, because it's just a requirement of working in transition houses that you're willing to break the law. It's just a basic requirement. You have to be able to take women who don't have papers. You have to be willing to take women who have wrong-headed court orders. You have to be willing, you know, I've had women tell me they killed their husbands, and I was not about to turn them in. And, you know, I don't know whether those murders actually occurred or not, and I didn't need to know. I needed to know that this woman was escaping abuse and that the world was not a safe or fair place for her, and my job was to stick with her until she and her kids could get safe. So, but, I'm not exceptional about that. I'm just exceptional in that I blab about it. And lots of women were doing quite dangerous interventions to stay in solidarity with women who needed help.
You know, I have so much respect and admiration for what you're saying. And I have had tears on my eyes through most of this interview. And at the same time, what does it mean when we even have to talk about the fact that women need to escape from the fathers of their children, that women need that this is even necessary, that it's completely appalling to me that your work is necessary.
Yeah, me too. But it's appalling to me that racism, you know, included lynching. It's appalling to me that workers are killed on the job or are left without protections on the job or are poisoned and used up on the job. I mean, it's a basic horrific fact of the inequalities.
So I want to read you a quote from, you won the Gandhi Day Award in 2013. Mm-hmm. And this is a fairly long quote from you, from your acceptance speech. And I'm wondering if I can read the quote and then ask you a couple questions about it.
Sure.
And you said, religious and metaphysical influences 100 years ago led Gandhi to believe that he personally embodied the struggle to the extent that he believed that his mastery over his own violent impulses, his own sexuality, his hungers, even over his own wish to live, could, in and of itself, influence the struggle for Indian independence. Which sounds very neoliberal to me, by the way.
Yeah.
he believed that his worthiness at some level would make it so. Women, too, sometimes twist and contort, trying to make believe that enduring men's blows is saintly, that being good enough will end the blows. And that's something every abused child understands, is that if you're just good enough, you won't get hit, of course. But it's nonsense. There is no evidence for martyrdom. Men stop when someone stops them, or women escape. And to escape, women often leave, relinquish home, job, street, community, even children to make the bullying or violence end. What are we to do? What authority on earth above it, or on earth or above it, will intervene on our behalf? Women, each in our own house, office, and street, perceive the injustice of women's depressed status and all the violence against women. We share a righteous collective longing and ambition to end it. How can we stop tolerating our individual punishment for disobedience to the rule of patriarchy? What mass, nonviolent civil disobedience shall we construct to end it? And so my question is, do you have an answer to these questions? And especially what actions women could take globally to end the rule of men?
Well, here, this brings us back to Hedges, of course. I was writing that knowing that I was talking to a group of people who had invented the Gandhi Award and who I thought were likely to be very, very attached to nonviolent resistance. And while I admire that, I was trying to challenge them that I don't know what nonviolence there is for women as a group to be adhering to. And, you know, they're giving this award because they're kind of sanctifying me. And I wanted to say, don't over-rely on that. I mean, I live somewhere between my admiration for that nonviolence and my attachment to Dworkin, who says, get between him and her. And if you have to do that with a gun, do it. You know, so like there are moments where I remember very well one of the first women I worked with who she had four children and she was barely 20. And her oldest child was at that point 5 or 6. And I could see that the little girl was damaged. And I took her to a special testing outfit and a good institution in the town I was working in. And the little girl's name is Tina. And they told us in the interview after the testings were completed that Tina was damaged, that her ears were blocked, and her vision had gone blurry. And they believed that that was in part because she wanted not to hear and not to see what was going on in her household. And I found it absolutely crushing and heartbreaking. But there I was. I was supposed to be the one who was not in crisis and get this woman out of the appointment back home. So I was driving her. And all I could think of was, dear God, don't let this man step in front of me. If he steps in front of me, I'll kill him. Because I knew this child was now retarded to some extent, for the rest of her life. And it was because of this very human response of not being able to bear her mother being terrorized. And, you know, so I don't say nonviolence does it. If there was a great nonviolent strategy, I'd do it. To the extent that I can see one, I'm doing it. Help the women escape, help the women cohere into a movement, make the rest of our movement listen to these women and listen to what I've learned over the years, you know, and stand up to the men who are supposed to hold other men accountable, the men who can teach other men humanity, and demand it. Demand it from the left, who still undervalue women's oppression, and demand it from everyone. And those are the strategies I can see, so those are the ones I do. But, you know, there are real moments where it's hard not to just beat some guy up or order his execution. I don't. I've never supported law and order initiatives. I do support the rule of law, but not supporting right-wing law and order initiatives, because it seems to me those always backfire against the women and against people in general. So there's no hope in them. But otherwise, I just kind of, you know, live with the contradiction and keep moving forward as much as I can.
I want to sort of, we've got like 5 minutes left, and there's time to wind down, but I actually have a non-wind down question.
Okay.
Which is that sometimes my mom is 83, and she really enjoys watching like true crime shows on TV. So I watch those with her, and quite often they will be some guy who killed his wife because she wanted to get a divorce. And,
right.
You know, we talked about this, and my mom experienced this too, that my father tried to push her out of a moving car at 60
right.
when they
right.
were getting divorced. I mean, that's
right.
just ho-hum routine at this point, you know? This is what happens. And I always say to her, good grief, if they're not happy, why doesn't he just let her get a divorce? And then my mom will every time give me this look like, she'll say, the problem is not that he wants that he wants to be with her necessarily. The problem is he can't lose.
That's very close. I think that too, that they are actually very dependent figures, that being the abuser does not make you stronger, and exercising tyranny doesn't make you stronger as an individual. It makes you increasingly dependent on those you can tyrannize. It's a funny fact. It's a fact in racism. It's a fact in class politics, and it's a fact in women's liberation politics. Your mother's right that he can't bear the thought of losing her. It makes him crazy, and it relinquishes his own strength and his own independence to continue to colonize her, for lack of a better metaphor. Just like, you know, empires become fragile and endangered places because imperialism makes it so. And when men treat women the way they do, as colonized, slave-like characters, the men themselves lose personal integrity. They lose their strength.
Well, you know, really, in many ways, this is the question that started all of my work when I was a kid, is that I didn't have this language, but I was asking, if my father's behavior isn't making him happy, why is he doing it? And
right.
That, because it was very clear to me that he was losing the relationships with his children. I mean, losing
Absolutely.
Real relationships. And losing all sorts of things. And what he was gaining, of course, was, victories over everybody. And also, he didn't have to do the dishes. There's a real tangible sort of material gain that comes about, too.
Yeah, there's a he gains labor. He does gain slaves. And he also gains access to her as a sexual being. And access over his children, and often sexual access over his children, which means he doesn't have to ask. He doesn't have to live up to ordinary human requirements. And that's what they, you know, I really think that male psychology is such that no man thinks that he's living up to the version of masculinity that he's supposed to be living up to. So he cheats by bluffing, conning, or brutalizing. And, you know, the irony of the thing is, the more you con and cheat and brutalize, the more you are not living up to anybody's version of how to be a human being, never mind a male human being.
So I think my last major question, I would like to quote back something else that you've written, and then ask you about it. You say, there is no need for the work of breaking the silence, as we used to call it, or for making them understand, as some still fall into saying. Which, by the way, I also want to mention, you're a very elegant writer, as well as everything else.
Thank you.
They get it. Every authority gets it. If they don't, it's because they don't want to. Our tactics and strategies must now shift to reflect that documented reality. So first, unpack that sentence for us, and then in the couple minutes left, what tactics and strategies do you think the feminist movement should consider moving forward?
Right. So,
what do you think we should do is the question.
Well, I do think we should stop wasting any time on thinking that the problem is we have to educate authorities, not the individual men on the whole, and absolutely not the authorities, meaning not the police, not the schools, not the governments. It's absolute nonsense. They know. They know violence against women exists, they know who's responsible for it, and they know that they're not coping with it. So what I say is, we have to make more strategic decisions about what it's got, what we've got that we can withhold, what we've got that we can interfere with, that will jam the machinery of government, of capitalism, and of male supremacy, jam it in any way we can to make demands on the system. And that's hard to do, and it takes constant thinking because the machinery readjusts itself all the time. So, but it's not impossible. And I do think if we withdraw the energy from all the waste, you know, that goes into pretending we're going to educate the authorities to stop abusing women, we'd have that energy to work with to plan and strategize. Right now, I'm about to go off to a conference that a provincial government is holding, where they're about to spend a whole lot of money on services. And I know that they're doing that because there's been some very shocking cases in that province recently, and people are in an uproar about it, which is great. We need to stir up the uproar and stop being so satisfied that they're giving us services, because what they're giving us for services won't change a thing. And on the other hand, if we're in charge of those services, we need to make sure that they function the way I was describing earlier as feminist services. So they are gathering and honing women's anger and helping us each direct ourselves to change, making change.
So I guess my last question, or two questions. One of them is, what do you want listeners to this, especially women, to take away that they, if you could like plant one seed inside every woman who listens to the interview, what would it be?
Demand your equal status in any of the groups you're in, and exercise it when you've got it. But also, you should be part of an independent women's group. Whether you're an activist on the left, an environmental activist, an anti-racist activist, need to have part of your loyalty attached to an independent women's movement, because we need those independent groups to press the anti-capitalist groups and to press the environmental groups and to press the anti-racist groups, to keep them sharp on women. And at the same time, you know, within our women's groups, we need to be very sharp on making sure that we're not cooperating with capitalism or with racism, imperialism. We have to be very sharp about that. And that doesn't mean just let brown people in your group. It means we have to actually strategically think and move. For instance, we should not be accepting money from large capitalist corporations, thinking that that's somehow going to give us the money to work against male supremacy. It just doesn't work like that. We're just sabotaging ourselves.
The last part of this may make my last question moot, but I'm going to try it anyway, which is that let's pretend that suddenly you became the queen of all things, all things stopping men's violence against women.
Yeah.
And you could institute policies, but you can't like stop patriarchy tomorrow. So the system still stands. What policy things would you try to implement in the meantime that would dramatically help women and move us toward ending patriarchy?
Well, at the moment, with the help of thinkers in other centers, we have you know, we have some things we're working on. We know that guaranteed livable income is a strategy that we need to consider. That's a policy of every government having an obligation to see to it that people have a basic amount of money from which they can pay their rent and buy their food without being producers in the capitalist system. So that's entirely doable. I can't give you a short version. You have to read and think about that, but I think that's one great strategy. I think we do have to keep a system of democratic governance at the moment, or get one, and that we absolutely need criminal law. That's one of the debates that's going on. I believe we need criminal law. I believe that we we can't leave every woman on her own against every man, that we, until we can organize as communities to hold men accountable, we need the rule of law. So that's a, throws a wrench in a lot of people's systems, but I do believe that. So that's another thing. I do work on holding the police accountable for carrying out the laws on violence against women, and try to prevent the government from kicking violence against women out of the courts and out of the policing systems, which is what they're trying to do. And I think in the States it might be important to have the ERA. In Canada, we do have a charter. It hasn't worked 100% for us, hasn't even worked 90% for us. But it has helped develop the idea that equal citizenship, if there's going to be citizenship, we need it to be equal for women, and we need ways of thinking about that. So those two national law things are important. In the States, you've got a problem in that all the violence against women money is coming through the criminal justice system. That's a big problem. You need to have money going to the independent women's movement. And that can't be accountable to the criminal justice system. It has to be accountable to fundamental rights, either a human rights approach or an ERA approach or something like that, that keeps the conversation going. You know, when is the rule of law useful and when is law and order a big danger? Is that helpful?
Oh, it's all great. It's all great. And unfortunately, we're out of time, and I would like to thank you for being on the program. I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Lee Lakeman. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.
Thanks very much. I enjoyed it.